Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2003, May 5. And I be John Pasmino. Our topic today is Omicron Ceti, also called Mira Stella, which is simply Latin for marvelous or wonderful star. It relates to a particular star now approaching a maximum of its brightness in June, which are called Mira stars. By the way, that's M-I-R-A. That's the proper name of this particular star, and that name is the name for the all stars whose behavior is similar to Omicron Ceti. I said it comes to its peak. The star does not shine steadily. In fact, for about the first 100 or so years of its discovery, it was a truly unique example in the sky of a star whose brightness changed, disappearing from view below naked eye limit, and then reappearing to become a average or even brighter than average star in the constellation Cetus. Make sure you have two files. In addition to the audio file you're listening to, you need the video file with the slides. If you missed it, go to www.nyskies.org. On the home page, you see near the top the jump words audio video files. Jump on it. You're now on the AV files page. It explains why you need both files for the presentation. One without the other is nonsense. It also explains about the e-group for New York Skies, where you can banter and chat astronomy with the other astronomers there. Then there's a list of all the seminars in digital form, which started in February 2001, deep in the middle of the coronavirus episode. And the one you're looking for at the bottom, which is titled Omicron Ceti, Stella Mira. You have the PPT file, that's the video, and you're listening here now to the MP3 file. Okay, you may want to pause so you can crank up the video file and set it to slide one, and then resume. Okay, you're standing on slide one. In last seminar about observing the deep sky objects in the Milky Way and also other galaxies, I left you an interesting project for your club. Because in the spring, many clubs have astronomy days that's fading away, but you might have an Earth Day exhibit, or you may want to have something to start off your summer public star viewings, because many of them were in recess during the winter and early spring. So what better project could there be than a scale model of our galaxy, which you make out of chicken wire, papier-mâché, cotton, pipe cleaners, maybe plaster, craft balls and ornaments, And you set this up someplace, and your visitors can look at it, and someone narrates it through a PA or a bullhorn. And I suggested that the scale would be one astronomical unit, that's the distance from the Earth to the Sun, is 1 millimeter, so that the whole solar system out to the orbit of Pluto, 80 millimeter diameter, would fit comfortably on the square hard case of a computer diskette. So many of you did this, and I got a lot of responses. They almost all embedded a correct answer to the fundamental question, what would be the diameter of this scale model? Well, at first, you thought you made an arithmetic error. No, you did the calculation, you used the data from slides in the last session or from reference books. No, the diameter of the solar system, diameter of the Milky Way, whatever. You change from millimeters to kilometers and light years to astronomical units and stood on your head and multiplied. Then, no, this can't be it. This can't be right. Especially since you already had in mind a place which was willing to have you exhibit this thing, say for a weekend. You know, the polo field or the parking lot of a shopping mall, which for some reason was going to be closed on a certain weekend, so the place would be empty. Or maybe a farm. You know, some of you members work in or live near active farms, and you know, farms segments are left fallow, that is, no planting on it, so the soil rejuvenates. Well, maybe on that area, or maybe a half kilometer square or something, you could put your model. But as much as you did the numbers over and over again, you realized you had the right answer. Your model of the Milky Way would not fit in a polo ground or a soccer ground. It would not fit in even the largest parking lot that you could imagine. It would not even fit in the largest single farm. It would not even fit within your whole county. Because that Milky Way, depending on the exact method you use to calculate it, was between 6,000 and 7,000 kilometers diameter. So let's look at slide 2. Your scale model, the Earth-Sun distance being 1 millimeter, is bigger than all of North America. So slide 2 shows, I tried to get the figures in the right proportions. On the lower right, we see a stylized area view of North America, the United States being in the middle, Alaska in the upper left of that panel, and northern Canada going into the Arctic Ocean and near the horizon. You have a blue atmosphere, and then at the bottom we see Mexico and Central America, which is often considered part of North America anyway, and the Caribbean islands and even piece of Greenland. And in the upper left, to just about the right size, I have a model of the Milky Way, and it is bigger than North America. Now, one person, probably in frustration, wrote back to me and said, Oh, this is going to be a big model. I mean, put it on the moon. Yeah, if you put it on the moon, that should be big enough. Well, at the top center is the moon sized to North America. It's rather more than about two-thirds or so the diameter of the moon compared to the distance between the east and west coast of the United States. And the model is about twice the diameter of the moon. Meaning, if you were to build this thing and somehow assembled it in space, you know, maybe a couple of million launches of the Super Heavy by SpaceX, and in orbit near the moon, well, let's say at one of the ground points of the moon, so it would be a stable orbit, and turn it so that's face on to us, it would be about 1 degree in diameter. Now, those of you who bit the bullet, realized they were making the right computation, they didn't slip a decimal point, they didn't add instead of subtract, and all of that. I know some of you, you tried to do this alone, and then had written that, I gotta call my buddy. And over beer and nachos, you said, okay, now give me this number. Okay, where's the astronomical unit? Okay, how many kilometers is that? And after all was done, you realize how big our own galaxy is. If you consider the history of astronomy, how could there be anything other than our Milky Way? Our Milky Way must be the entirety of physical existence, beyond which there is nothingness. Now, some of you have a problem visualizing or contemplating what is nothingness. But nothingness is what existed in your mind before you were conceived, before you were born. You experienced nothingness. And that's what, until the 1920s, we thought was outside the Milky Way galaxy. I did another computation. How far out can we see from the solar system to optically observe? Now bear in mind, all the gas dust in the Milky Way blocks our view like a cosmic fog. So optically, we can only see out to roughly 5,000 light, let's say 4,000 as a practical maximum limit. And if you apply the scale factor, it turns out that you could only see around, say, the computer diskette, which has the picture of the Milky Way you drew on it, out to about 55 kilometers, which would be about the distance across a rather large county or a metropolitan district. It's a little smaller, rather smaller than the New York Sky region. New York Sky region goes out to about 100 kilometers. But even so, the metropolitan district of your town or the zone around your town, which is socially and economically tied to it, would be about the farthest extent of optical exploration of our galaxy. And if you can locate that in the lower right corner, where that would be in the United States, or my readers in Quebec or in Canada, again, you get the impression of just how effing humongous, that's a word, the Milky Way galaxy is. So you had a lot of fun with this. I guess the bottom line is, you're not having a scale model of the Milky Way galaxy, but you probably ought to get a poster of it, and you'll say, this is it. Alright, slide 3. Our title slide for today, which kind of summarizes the text in the AV files page in reverse order. One of your friends may have come onto the slides, the PPT file, but he lacks the MP3. So it tells him, go to the AV file page and download the narration. After that is a suggested supplemental reading, which in this case I couldn't offer any, and you really don't need any help from me, because the astronomy literature in the web, in textbooks, videos and so on regarding the star Mira and others like it called long period variable stars is so deep and extensive that I never bothered to write an article describing it. I'll just be repeating what everyone else was saying, and of course you have the diversity of explanations. So without further more ado, we move on to slide 4. We have a scene from this borrowed picture where the photographer drew the stick figures for the constellation Cetus and also labeled a few stars. And the star in the circle near the center of the picture, labeled Mira, is the star Mira, which in this case is actually visible, a naked eye star in the constellation of the sea monster, often called the whale. All mythical representations fail to resemble any whale that I can think of. And if you live near the ocean front, Pacific or Atlantic, you know what whales look like. Well, at least in the New York City area, they're being beached and then dying on our waterfront, on the beaches. Something to do with construction out in the ocean for electric wind turbines. Any case, or you may have gone on whale watches where you board a charter boat, you go out maybe 50 kilometers or so and just watch the whales playing around in the ocean. But all pictures in astronomy books, catalogs for this constellation show a rather puffy, hulky, monster looking creature, which we'll see in the next slide. Anyway, in this here, the star Menkar near the left side and the little polygon of stars that are joined by lines is the head of the beast. And then down at the bottom where it says Batan Cetus, Venter Seti, or the belly of Cetus, that's the belly torso, and on the right, Denim Cetus, Cauda Seti, the tail. So the beast is flowing or swimming to the left toward Taurus, which is the Pleiades up against the left margin of the picture. And Mira is in the neck, or probably in the, well, according to the Latin expression, in the bronchial region just below the throat. It's a rather hefty animal, which doesn't have a neck in the normal sense. If you think in terms of a muscle head, like a guard or a vigorous man, then has a very thick neck was is almost the same width as his whole head. That's kind of what the neck on Cetus is. This picture, just by chance, happens to be the scene that we should see in June when Mira comes with maximum brightness, about what you see in this picture here. It would appear like an extra star in the constellation. There would be a pre-dawn event with Cetus loaded on the horizon like here, and possibly, depending on where you are in your time zone and what your latitude is, it would be dawn will be coming and some of the dimmer stars will be faded out, so you could, at least to start, need binoculars to pick the star out from the background. What most of us probably will do, we'll start with the Pleiades, hop over to Mencar, so from Pleiades to Mencar and about an equal distance beyond should put you in the region of Mira. And toward the end of this lesson, I have a more detailed chart which will help you to actually make brightness estimates of the star. So, what is this Cetus beast? We see that in slide 5. The first person to actually catalog the star Mira and then draw it on a map is Bayer, B, Bravo, A, Y, Yankee, E, R, in his Uranimetria of 16-3, which, by the way, is floating out on the internet, and I have a PDF copy of it from which I cut this picture. It's the page, one of two of them, for the stars in Cetus. If you know your Greek alphabet, your astronomers, you do know it. In the left hand, I think this is the second column, you have the Greek letters, which he assigned to the stars, and in Latin to the right is the anatomical place in Cetus where that star is. If you go near the bottom, well, you surely recognize the Greek letter pi. You can be a non-astronomer, but you know mathematics, so you know pi. And the Greek letter just above it, looking like a small O, is omicron. And it tells you there that it's next to the sub-throat area, kind of near the lungs. It's using a rather unusual Latin word. It's not the normal word for lung or throat, and it took a little digging in a good Latin dictionary to figure it out. Even my doctor didn't even know what that crazy word was. Coronara. Well, any case, it's in the bronchial area of the beast, and the page rolls over to the second page for the remainder of the Greek alphabet to Omega. Before Bayer, the star was not specifically called out, not even as a regular star. I mean, I would have thought that during a period when it was near brightest, another astronomer at that time would have cataloged it, not realizing that it waxes and wanes. So I looked in Ptolemaeus' catalog, and I looked in Ulugh Beg, I looked in Copernicus, I looked in Hevelius, and none of them showed it, even as a regular star. So all I can say is that maybe when they compiled their catalog, the star was dim, unnoticed, or below naked eye limit. So the first one who actually put it on the map, literally, was Beyer. A picture 6 shows the allegorical creature of Cetus. This, by the way, is not the one that Beyer drew. I tried to use his figure, but there was too much clutter. One of the things about those early astronomers, besides being a map maker where you put the stars in the proper places on a grid, you also had to be an artist. So he kind of ran away with himself on his charts, which are drop-dead beautiful, but many times the stars have been camouflaged in, say, the hair or the scales or clothing of the creature. But here, the star mirror, a little left of center, is explicitly labeled, and then immediately to the left is a little omega, and a little farther to the left is the star symbol. I don't know about you, but this is not the kind of animal I would want to be near anything, neither whether it's swimming or yachting offshore or out on the high seas on those little wooden matchbox ships of the ancient world, even coming into the Renaissance. See, but that is what the star is in Mira. And it's drawn as a kind of average star, so I don't know if the author of this picture actually observed it and scaled it properly with the symbol, or he read about it being bright sometimes and just put it there as more or less near maximum brilliance. Some of the early history of the star is laid out in slide 7. I'm not going to read it for you here. You can, you know, snap that picture and print it out, or otherwise keep it handy. But essentially, the first definite recognition that this is a star that appeared, disappeared, and came back again was by Fabricius in 1596. Well, he saw it first in that year, and he thought it was a nova. It faded from view, and he thought that was the end of it. Then a few years later, 10 years later, he looked and said, wait a minute, I saw that star about 8 or 10 years later ago. It came back, and he watched it, and it brightened, and then dimmed and faded again. By around 1620, other astronomers picked up on this, and it was recognized as a star that had the miraculous property of shining and fading, appearing and then disappearing. And it took a little more years to figure out that the period, the interval between its reappearances, either peak to peak, was 11 months. And more accurately, toward the bottom of the slide, 333 days, well, which had been refined since, 332 days. I know some reference books tell me it's 331.9876 days, but take my advice, 332 days. And some other astronomers played around with it over the years. There's been some suggestion that maybe it was seen and cataloged or noted, but not recognized, that they were just catching the star near its brighter phase. For instance, Beyer apparently did not know that he was recording a star which vanished and just happened to be coming back into naked eye range when he compiled his catalog. So Beyer probably was the first astronomer to see the star since it faded in 1596. Now the brightenings in 97, 98, and 1600 were probably missed. So by 1603, it caught Beyer's attention, and Fabricius himself in 1609 had been cataloging it and were following it and came to the conclusion that it really is the same star which comes and goes. The name mirror was applied to it by Hevelius, which simply means marvelous or wonderful. If you know Romance language, mirar as a verb means to marvel at, to wonder at, or look, look. I'm sure if you live in any community with a Hispanic presence, you have seen or heard one person talking to another and pointing to, say, a fancy car or a street performer or a billboard with a certain sign. Mira, mira, look, look. Okay? Okay, in 8, we actually have the introductory page to a major article about Mira. It has some pretty text at the top explaining this was the first true variable star, which is a star which continually changes in light output, as opposed to a nova, which was well known in the Middle Ages and even going back to the beginning of the current era, where a star suddenly appeared, luminous as such, faded away, and that was it. It had the one glorious episode. And remember, 1572, about 25 years before Fabricius's observations, Tycho Brahe discovered his supernova. See, but that supernova never again came back as in a luminous form. We did observe it twice in 1572 and again in about 2008. And a lesson a while back, I threw it out as a quiz. How could we have seen the same event 420 years apart? Okay, but this is a star that waxes and wanes in brilliance, and at the bottom we see a long range of observations showing the ups and downs of the star's brightness, the magnitude scales on the left of each row, and you have the years running under it, and you see it's pretty regular. The peak brightness is not always the same, but it's up there, third magnitude to second magnitude, and the dimmest down to around 10th magnitude. Sometimes it goes to 11th. Sometimes it bottoms out at 9th. Bear in mind that in the 1600s, when the telescope first came into use, the diameter of the lens, the objective lens, was actually very small, about 20 to 30, maybe 40 millimeter diameter, made of some pretty crude glass, and believe it or not, the star actually vanished, even telescopically. But 10th magnitude virtually any current home telescope, even small ones that just put on tabletop, will follow through its entire period of oscillation, which actually makes it a favorite for home astronomers, because the star is pretty repetitive, it doesn't pull any crazy surprises on you, and you have the chance to see it through a major part. You may lose about 10th or 11th magnitude if you have a small scope, like a 30, 40 millimeter, which was like the entry level refractor of the 1950s and 60s. And you may still have it banging around. You probably use it for a guide scope on your big telescope or something. But otherwise, you get the whole cycle. And you could observe it because of the 11-month period. Observe it maybe once every 2 weeks, except at the time of its maximum, maybe every few days, every week, and again near its minimum, every few days, every week. But during the rise and fall, you can spread the observations out. So that is the star Mira. Now, what separates this star from other variable stars? Variable stars really were not found in any great numbers until about the mid-1700s. It remained the singular example of a star that waxed and waned, swelled up and shrank in brightness. Okay. Stars change their brightness for a variety of reasons, and this is not really a session on variable stars or the internal astrophysics of stars, but substantially, at least from an observational point of view, a mirror type or long period variable star has an amplitude, the range between maximum and minimum, of 5 or more magnitudes. So from 2nd magnitude to 10th magnitude, that's 8 magnitudes. Okay, that fits. It will have a rather regular period, repeated cyclical, of from 50 to about 500 days, and that period is substantially stable. And you can see from the couple of decades there, we have it, that's satisfied. It also is a red star in color, like Antares or Betelgeuse. In fact, in the 1800s, when variable stars were getting to be kind of too numerous to ignore, some star maps would actually label the red stars with a little letter R, meaning red, because the predominant number of variable stars being found happen to be red, and going back and reverse engineering the history, most of them were long period variables. They're easy to detect photographically, but optically is kind of by chance, and there's always the chance that, wait a minute, did I see that star last time? Maybe it's hazy. Maybe the thing, maybe it's too much twilight. Well, I'll mark it down anyway. And then, a couple of weeks later, so let me check this star again. Oh boy. Was it, okay, it's the same brightness as the one to the east. And what was it the last time? Was it the same? No, was it brighter? Oh God, maybe it was Dimmer. Okay, and so on. And you get a lot of false positives also, so it was really hit or miss for discovering variable stars, and in fact we ended up waiting until photography was applied to astronomy, astrophotography, in the 1890s to really pick out variable stars. And from then on, the number of variable stars cataloged is probably close to 100,000 today. In a more detailed view of the light variations is shown in slide 9 from records of the British Astronomical Association from 2001 to 2011. This way you can see a little more clearly the rise and fall of the star, and you can better see that the peak magnitude does change a bit cycle to cycle, as does the trough, the valley. It's not quite so obvious that the period, the interval between peaks or between valleys, also wanders a couple of days, 330 days, 335 days, but it's stable enough that you can have a anticipated season a couple of years ahead when the star would be bright. And over the 400 and some odd years that we've been watching the star, it hasn't done anything really peculiar, and so it's dynamically stable, as we would say, for a system of some sort which has motion, animation, activity, but remains basically uniform over time. 10 and 11 gives some specs and data for the star. 10 is for mirror, and 11 is for a white dwarf companion that was discovered in the 1910s as a spectrometric companion, which is to say, spectroscopy or spectrography had advanced to the point where we could recognize that you had the stellar spectrum of mirror, and then superimposed on it was the spectrum of another kind of star, a white dwarf, and the orbital motion of the two stars was revealed in the Doppler shifting of the two sets of lines, one for mirror A and the other for mirror B. Around 1923, the companion was visually observed, and in the 2000s, it was detected and studied better in the visual, infrared, and X-ray by astrophysical satellites, and also by the new supersized telescopes. But we come to an interesting question. This star is fantastic. In addition to the Doppler shifting due to the orbital motion, the lines in the spectrum for mirror A showed a oscillating Doppler shift, red and blue, in step with the variations in light, that is, the swaying back and forth in wavelength in the spectrum, was also 332 days. It took a while to figure out what the hell is going on here. understand that up until the dawn of World War II, we really did not know what a star is. We were able to figure out that they came in different sizes, and we kind of imagined that they all looked like the sun, except that, well, they shined yellow, they shined blue, they shined orangey. And models, which are, some are still in existence. The, you might want to check out the astronomy department in your local college. The reception room or the library could well have a model showing the sizes and colors of stars, which was built, you know, 100 years ago, but only, and they just simply kept it up. It was just pretty. When we figured out what stars really were, they were globs of hydrogen which were consuming hydrogen into helium, or in the case of Mira, other elements being merged to form still other elements, and the radiation output varied because that energy process was oscillating. Then it came to us, the wobble in the Doppler shift of Mira A was due to the physical upswelling in size and downswelling in size, as if the star was breathing. And with the deployment of the Hubble Space Telescope, and then subsequently supersized telescopes on the ground using adaptive optics, we actually, in slide 12, resolved Mira into disk. So these blotches are the real surface photospheres of the stars. The upper panel shows a very wide resolution of the two stars, Mira A on the right, the upper panel on the right, and on the left is the white dwarf companion. Now it looks at first that the white dwarf is larger in size than Mira, but that's an artifact because the white dwarf has a greater surface brightness. It's a hotter star. White dwarfs are hot stars. They're spectral class A. And there may be some bleeding of the image into adjacent pixels. But it's a very pixelated image. It was taken specifically to study the white dwarf. In the lower panel, in visible and other lighting, we see, quote, you know, optical, or certainly in the visual, optical image of the actual disk of Mira itself. Now, in some of the pictures I've seen, the disk is not actually spherical, but it's lumpy. That may be simply because of the exposure didn't capture the dimmer parts of the disk, and it's a photographic artifact. On the other hand, a star the size of Mira, which we'll see in a couple of slides, is so huge, the gravity is kind of thin at the photosphere, that the material could probably swirl around asymmetrically. But those are early images that actually resolve the disks of stars. Now we're able to do this for Mira because it's a giant star, well, a red giant star, and it's also pretty close to us, about 90 or so parsecs away, which means that it's really one of the closest of the long period variable stars. Not the absolute closest, but certainly one of the closest, the most studied, even today, after 400 years. We're still dicking around with it. There's a lot of secrets this guy did not let us in on yet. And also, it is the brightest of all the known long period variable stars. The ones which happen to be a bit closer don't have as much of a range and don't really make them so prominent when they're at full brightness. I mentioned that Mira was a red star. It is red because the schematic color used for spectral class M stars, which in turn are cool stars whose photospheres are in the order of about 3,000 or 2,500 Kelvin. In 13, we see profiles or tracings of sample spectra of cool stars. One of the things you'll notice, this is all in the optical range, you have the wavelength at the bottom, that the continuum rises and would peak at the extreme red end, or toward the, with the stars near the bottom, off the chart in the infrared. This is one of the reasons what inhibited us to study red giants in general, not just the long period variable stars, but also supergiants and other stars on that cool end of the spectrum, and also red dwarfs, which have spectra similar to this, but are very, very subluminous. Because when we were observing from the ground, and we didn't have the instruments to receive infrared radiation, or spectrometrically receive it, then the cutoff was there around 7,000 angstrom or 700 nanometers, and we had to more or less speculate what happens farther off the chart. But with the advent of observatories in very dry locations, and with the more modern digital sensing devices, and with astrophysical satellites, we can observe in the infrared, and an awful lot. In fact, I might hazard by today most of the work, as gauged by a number of articles written, are infrared observations, although there's a very good representation in gamma rays, X-rays, radio emission. Nevertheless, optical observations, particularly by home astronomers, is very, very much an element in the science of long period variable stars, which is one of the reasons why home astronomers are urged by an astronomy center such as the British Astronomical Association, or a dedicated variable star center like the American Association of Variable Star Observers, to maintain watch on these stars. But that shows you why the stars look red, because most of the radiation we are receiving within the human eye sensitivity is in the red part of the spectrum, long wavelengths. If we take the color or the temperature and plot it against the output of light, either luminosity or absolute magnitude, we get the situation in slide 14, which is the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, which is the vade mecum in astrophysics. We had a whole lesson on this a little while back. You may want to play it again after doing the current lesson. So the temperature and spectral class are horizontal axes, and absolute magnitude or luminosity on the vertical axis. And on the right center, the little bluish area where it says mirror type stars is where Mirror and others like him live. Which is to say, if a star during its life ends up having spectral class M and luminosity near 100 suns, the chances are excellent that it will become or turn into a long period variable star. And if, as the star continues evolving in its life, the combination of temperature and absolute magnitude move off of that boundary, then the star ceases to be a long period variable star. It could become another kind of variable if it falls into one of the other zones, which are other kinds of variables which are outside of today's session. We will look eventually down the road or the classical Cepheids type of star. But right now we're looking at the mirror or long period variables, and they're over on the right side of the HR diagram, kind of hugging the right edge or the long wavelength limit of the optical range, and in the area of plus 1 to 0 absolute magnitude, they will be the domain, the turf for the mirror type stars. So they're not really super giants, they are large, and they're not all that luminous, but they are visible at great distances, and they are very red. 15, 16, 17 illustrate one of the properties of cool giant stars, including Mira, namely the existence of molecules. That is, the stars are so cool that the nuclei of the atoms that make up the star can actually coalesce and become stable molecules instead of remaining as individual atoms. So in 15, we have the classical type of spectrum, the photographic spectrum of Mira. It's actually an old one. I deliberately took this, that is, accepted this picture, because it showed what we had to work with right up through the time when I was new to astronomy. The first real major improvement in spectrometry came with the building of the 5-meter telescope at Mount Palomar. That's when grating type spectrographs came into use. Prior to then, all spectra were based on prism spectrographs. But in the prism era, this is the kind of spectrum we could obtain, and I guess it's a miracle for my predecessor astronomers that they were able to detect in that spectrum lines due to titanium oxide. Now, you will hear about titanium oxide over and over again when you read about red giant stars or the properties of M-type stars, blah, blah, blah. Well, there are many other elements that will form compounds. It's just that titanium, because of the quantum physical layout of its shells of electrons, will make more prominent and more easily recognizable features in a spectrum. There was a time before about 1930 when we thought that the density or prominence of the spectral lines was an index of the percent or portion of that element in the star. So if you read textbooks from the 1920s, say to the beginning of the 20th century, when photographic spectrometry got going, that stars were made of the same kind of elements as on the Earth, which is true, but they thought that the stars were solids like the Earth, and their surface had a dirt or rock or whatever with iron and carbon and cobalt and nickel and titanium and vanadium, sulfur and so on, sort of like the Earth, and its atmosphere, the photosphere, was somehow, because we didn't understand nuclear reactions yet, luminous. It took Payne Gaposchkin, actually a woman astronomer at Harvard, who actually became the first chairman of a distinct astronomy department at Harvard, to show that, no, if you have to apply quantum mechanics, which itself is a fairly new discipline, which bypassed astronomy upbringing, to show that the intensity or the density of the lines is not just the portion of the element in the star, but is also the ease at which the line can be formed for a given temperature regime. But anyway, that's a classical indication of molecular behavior in the atmosphere of Mira. The 16 and 17 are the contemporary way of doing spectroscopy or spectrometry, using the digitized profile, wavelength horizontal, and then a relative density vertical. And 16 gives the extent of carbon molecules, and most of the ones I see there are carbon monoxide, but you see the wavelength and the places in the spectrum where they are detected. And it's in the micron range, which is the near infrared. I forget what instrument was used. It could be a ground-based one, but it might also be from one of the astrophysical telescopes up in orbit. See, but that shows a carbon molecule. Also note that the continuum is not as obvious as in hotter stars, down to say class Kay and Hatter, because of the ability of molecules to form, the energy levels in molecules are much more complex than those in individual atoms, and therefore the number of absorptions and emissions in the spectrum is much greater, and you have a more ragged, less obvious continuum. Slide 17, a similar type of plot for titanium oxide and vanadium oxide, and you can compare the two in this show. Now, if you're wondering how the hell do you know that this spike is titanium oxide, but that one is vanadium oxide, but this other one is carbon monoxide, well, that's the skill of the spectrometrist, the person who studies or measures spectra. And you need skill in nuclear physics, chemistry, atomic physics, as well as thermodynamics and a bit of hydrodynamics, because the whole thing of the spectra takes place in a fluid environment, the gases and vapors around the photosphere. So most of us, including myself, I was simply accept, you tell me that titanium oxide, I say fine. I mentioned Mira is a giant star, and we see this in figure 18. In the center is the star itself. There's a thin leader extending out from it toward the 4 o'clock position. The star, if it replaced the Sun, would be roughly the size of the Earth's orbit. We see Mars is just outside, but surrounding the star is a cloud of all those cool, relatively speaking, molecules. Now, when we say cool, I mean, it's as hot as, say, the gas flame in your stove. Enjoy it while you can. And that's around 2500 K. So that's a indication how hot these stars really are. And actually, we'll come back to that fact a little later on. I'll show you two interesting pictures and show you a very, very common mistake. It's an understandable mistake, but nevertheless, it can give you false impressions. All right, the molecular cloud, okay, these are shown as very nice circles or disks. The actual star is a big fluff ball, and the molecules in there are more like clouds or mists. And when the star grows and shrinks, and we'll actually see a picture of this, some of that material reaches the escape velocity in the thin gravity that far away and shows up in pictures as a dust trail, similar to that we see along the paths of comets that would eventually, if they intersect the Earth, cause meteor showers. But these are clouds of dust, this particulate matter, trailing behind Mira as it executes its linear proper motion in space. But the dust cloud extends pretty far into the main belt of asteroids. So when we say how big is Mira, well, the photosphere is only, quote-unquote, about the diameter of the Earth's orbit, so the thing is about 100 times bigger than the Sun. But then you have a translucent shell or shroud of the cool molecules, which are continually lofted up from the star as the star swells. So you have the mechanical pressure and radiation pressure to make that cloud. 19 shows the high resolution of the disk of the star on different dates, which are noted, and compared to there the orbit of the Earth in the middle for size comparison, and it shows the heaving and sighing, a breathing effect of the star. It's a little contrary to what you might think when the star is largest, say in the upper right, but also happens to be dimmest. That's near the minimum, and in the lower or the upper left, when it's near its minimum size, this includes the molecule cloud, it's the brightest, and you have intermediate stages on the lower half. So this actually is a pulsating star. So as it pulsates, it changes size and also emits more or less luminous energy, and also energy in other wavelengths. I note particularly infrared, because that's where the continuum comes to a peak in the spectrum. So the life of a star in slide 20 is really an antagonistic struggle between the gravity, which tends to collapse the star, and the fusion processes in the middle, where the temperature and pressures enable atoms to coalesce and cause radiation pressure to maintain the star, you know, at an extended radius. If that fusion process should shut off, which it does in the case of a supernova, then the star will collapse cataclysmically and you do get the supernova event. But as long as there is energy generation in the middle, the star will expand to a particular size and kind of stay there. Now, in the case of a variable star, where the processes inside are not constant and stable, but oscillate, then you will get the effect, among other types of stars, the mirror variable star, where the fusion processes are shifting between a high and low mode over a more or less dynamically stable period. In the case of mirror, a 8 magnitude change over 11 months, you know, repeated one after the other. So the inside arrows that are pointing out get stronger or weaker, whereas the gravity for a given diameter remains the same. Of course, when the pressure pushes the star out, the gravity there is weaker, you're farther away from the center of mass, and in fact the normal turbulent movements of the material could exceed the radially outward velocity of escape, and that material is lost to the star, and indeed mirror stars do ablate, as it is called, material. We'll also see a little later on that mirror loses mass to its white dwarf companion, the white dwarf is a little more massive than Mira itself and can pull material from the star when the star is the greatest extent out. And this is revealed most dramatically in the X-ray region, notably by the Chandra astrophysical satellite. But that's kind of what goes on inside a star. During the life of a star, as long as there's energy processes in the center, the star will remain a star. Before a star is born, there is no fusion in the center, and the material is able to stay outwardly extended because of the mechanical bearing strength or by gravity. But even there, gravity tends to warm and heat as you compress it downward until finally it ignites into a star. Now, compressing gases is a fundamental force in engineering. You can play with this yourself. If you take a balloon, partially inflate it, so it's kind of limp, tie it off, then pump it with your hand, and you'll be amazed how hot that balloon gets, simply by compressing gas, the atmosphere. Move on to 21. A dramatic composite showing the use of multispectral imaging of the star by various astrophysical satellites. We have here the Galax satellite in the ultraviolet, and we have the infrared in the middle, and we have on the right the X-ray from Chandra. We get very, very different views of the star. Notice that the infrared is showing the center of the nucleus of the, in other words, each picture is an enlargement of the previous one using a different wave band. I'll show details of the right and left panels in the next couple of slides. Okay, slide 22 shows the right panel of the previous one. In the upper left is a X-ray, false colors and all of that, because you can't see X-rays. The star Mira is on the right side, and the companion white dwarf is in the lower left, and the image seems to be connecting the two stars. Now, of course, this is just a single picture, but the Saunders sent a whole sequence, a video, showing that the material from the shell or cloud of molecules is being siphoned off onto the white dwarf, and there's an artist rendering on the right panel showing material being sipped off of the A component and going into the white dwarf as an accretion disk. Mira happens to be then the closest of what we call symbiotic stars. SYMB Bravo IOT Tango IC, meaning life together. The two stars are close enough and active enough to actually jive each other. And usually, but not always, it's the one star, the more massive, taking material off of the other star. Now, what will happen to the white dwarf, I'm not sure, but I think eventually it will just pile up on that star and it will be a larger star. The white dwarf is already totally pooped out as far as radiating energy by nuclear fusion. See, but the idea that we discovered that the white dwarf is not simply a benign, detached companion, but is actually an integral part of the mirror system. There'll be 30 slides in this lesson, so we are nearing the end. What's your problem there? Oh, yeah, well, come on. You said, I heard what you said, oh, shucks. Oh, come on, now, how long do you want this lesson to go? I mean, already it's an hour and some 18 minutes, and maybe, well, who's that? Is that a dreidel? So, it's a woman, and she's spinning. Oh, it's a dervish. Oh, Kamala. You seem very, very excited. What? Oh, yes, yes. Joe is keeping you on his team. And you keep that nice house at the observatory in Washington. Okay, well, so by all means, spin down and get into your seat. Okay. Alright, okay. Are you all settled in there? Huh. Okay, fine. We continue. Okay, slide 23 shows the dust trail ablating off of the molecular cloud surrounding mirror, and you have some pieces here. The existence of knots or loops actually enables us to track the motion of the star through space. This is one of the iconic images in modern astronomy. I seem to recall, toward the end of the 20th century, a book, but my memory is a little bit vague, which was like the greatest or the most important or impressive pictures taken in astronomy, of course, from the century which is about to end. And usually they're ones which proved a theory or detected a suspected phenomenon or event, or made an unexpected or unanticipated discovery and whatever. Well, if a later edition is ever made for the 21st century, certainly this would be part of it. But that's, can't you see that star screaming its way through space and letting the stuff spill out? It's like the guy who has the old jalopy and he does drag racing, and then behind him are all the nuts and bolts and flanges and brackets that the car spit out. Well, that's what mirror is doing. Infrared is everything. In slide 24, we show the variations in the radiation in two infrared bands at the top compared to the optical wavelengths at the bottom. They're not quite synchronous. There's a little phase difference between them. I will note this. The magnitude scale on the infrared images is essentially meaningless as a visualizing parameter. There was an attempt in the 60s, 70s, even 80s to define stellar magnitude outside the optical range of the spectrum. And this was a total disaster. What we now do is we plot the digital output or a current reading or a relative percent or ratio. The magnitude should really be taken somewhat the way we do with decibels in electronics. One current is so many decibels greater than another. It does not mean that the one current is that many decibels louder in sound. See, the decibel in sound relates to the differential pressure on the eardrum due to the incoming sound pressure and the internal pressure that then transmits the sound inwardly to the brain. See, but the dB is simply signal ratio, and that's how you should treat the magnitude scales on diagrams or light curves, as we call them, which are outside the optical range of wavelengths. But we see that the, and I can't even, you know, if you take the magnitude difference between the two on the upper and lower, they are not the same as for the optical wavelength. So the whatever is doing it in infrared is more effective there than for the optical range. But the optical range is almost never observed as a fraction of the available records by campus astronomers. That's for the home astronomers, the bulk of us folk, to do. And there are occasions where the AAVSO, the American Association of Variable Star Observers, would get a request from a astronomer who says, look, I'm going to be studying this particular star during X and Y hours UT on such and such a date, and I'm doing this in the far ultraviolet using the whatchamacallit instrument on that satellite. Can you provide optical observation of that star in that same time block? And so AAVSO will put out an alert or a bulletin asking observers who follow that star or who have the equipment to do so to please help out. Of course, according to the time zone and day-night cycle at your location. The reason being that if I develop a theory or model to duplicate, say, the top light curve in the infrared, but then I get my visual data from AAVSO, my model does not produce that pattern of visual wavelength behavior. So I have to go back to the drawing boards and try something else. Mirror, because of its fascinating behavior, it's a red giant, and the pulses and all that, is one of the science fiction stars, along with Tau Ceti for Epsilon Origini, Al Gore, I'm trying to think of others. Well, they're probably 51 Cygni, 61 Cygni, 51 Pegasi, and a bunch of others that are stars which are so unusual that their behavior sounds science fiction. Of course, it's reality. But here we have in slide 25 two examples of artist illustrations for what it would look like if we were close into or a planet around our friend mirror. The one on the left, you probably recognize. If you have, say, a hand-me-down, or you bought it in a secondhand bookstore, books from the 1950s, which were co-sponsored by the Disney Company, about exploring, I think it was actually called The Exploration of Space, which actually contained material which were then embedded in some of the attractions in the original Disneyland in California. So this was painted as an illustration of the marvels and wonders to see when we finally achieved space travel in 1918. When you young boys and girls, there were only two genders then, will graduate from grammar school, you go through college, and you will get a job building and flying rockets to the stars. And the lower one is from a much later science fiction endeavor, or actually science fantasy is what I like to call it, because the pictures try to embody what was known about these stars rather than simply making up something, because the planets that you're standing on were made up until you discovered that stars other than the sun can have planets. I'm going to call your attention to something, a real mistake. It's an honest misconception. We're sitting a few diameters of mirror away from it, in the upper left, and many diameters away in the lower right picture. And, well, mirror has spectral class M, and you look at your schematic color chart, the star is red. And we did not have any disk resolution or observation outside the optical. It kind of looks like the sun, except it's red. Well, forgetting the diffuse photosphere, the cloud of molecules, and all of that, if we were so close as these two pictures show to mirror, it would not look red at all, even assuming that we maintained our vision sense the way it is on Earth. The reason being, that thing would be like the sun in the local sky, so overpoweringly brilliant that it would saturate all your color cells and the star would look white. Now, it could look red if you used really dense, let's stack a couple of eclipse filters and look at the star. It probably look like that, but these pictures apparently show naked eye views. No, you would see an incredibly brilliant white ball of fire in the upper left, and not quite so incredibly big white ball in the lower right picture. Spills on the floor because the paper soaked up liquids. And then, of course, he threw it away. But those books, I've seen them in antique bookshops going for 20 and more dollars, where they cost, you know, a quarter when I was in grammar school. What will we be seeing now for the coming maximum June 2023? If you look at the caption on page 26, it says that this is mid-June pre-dawn hours. I'm giving you this lesson now in May in order to let you watch the star come into view, and then you can ride it up to the maximum during the coming month. And then thereafter, you will see it peak and then slide down in brightness until probably by August or so, it would be beyond the naked eye range, and you'll need a telescope to follow it thereafter. So we're looking kind of east. I put a horizon glow to represent twilight. The only thing extra was I left the planetarium's own star names stay there. There was no real point to change them. And I also added the figures. So you see the ribbons of Pisces up at the top. In the upper left, we see the ram Aries, the nesting down. And then on the bottom, of course, the horizon, we see that sprawly figure for the sea monster, Cetus. Now, what actual illumination in the sky you will experience depends partly on your latitude and also whereabouts within your time zone you view. If you're in the western part of the time zone, you'll get a slightly darker sky. If you're in the eastern edge of your time zone, you'll get a sky that's a little brighter. You can't see this scene now, early May, because the sun will already have risen. The sun in May, early May anyway, is roughly halfway between Alcyone, the Pleiades, on the far left against the margin, and directly below it on the horizon, Aldebaran. So this would be a daytime view in May, and a twilight view in June, when the sun has moved farther along into the eastern part of Taurus. Now, let's look particularly at Aldebaran and Alcyone. I just mentioned that the sun is there right now in May. It'll be there next May and every May thereafter, the only change being the exceedingly slow drift due to precession. So within a lifetime, the sun is in the Pleiades-Hyades region during May. Now, the period for the pulsations of Mira are 11 months. Last year, and we'll look at this in a moment, the pulsations were in July, and in 2001 they were in August. Next year, they'll be in May. Which means that Cetus will be next to the sun, and therefore the star Mira and everything I surround it will be in daylight. So we will lose the optical view of Mira's maximum in 2024. We may have to wait till 2026 when the maximum occurs in March, and at that time we'll be seeing Cetus in the evening sky. So that peculiarity of losing sight of a star because the sun comes by, passes it, is very severe, most severe, for stars in and near the ecliptic. Well, okay, there's Pisces and there's Aries where the ecliptic runs through, so at least the northern part of, actually we have Taurus too, the northern part of Cetus with mirror will be affected by the proximity of the sun. That's called the sun gap. G-A-P, Papa. We can observe mirror in other wavelengths from the ground or from all wavelengths above the atmosphere in by satellite. If you are familiar with planetary observing, you know that there are exclusion periods, one every synodic period, where the planet is too close to the sun to observe. The same thing happens with other targets in the vicinity of the ecliptic. So keep this chart in mind when you are looking for mirror and its relation to the other constellations, the three zodiac ones, in the pre-dawn sky during June. The current activity of mirror we have in picture 27, and this shows the light curve, that is the plot of magnitude versus time, for the star in 2021 up through actually March of this year. I cut this picture during April, and the little box in the upper right shows that the latest observation at that time was March 8th. Now at first you may wonder, wait a minute, if I looked up data in late April and the latest observation is early March, what's going on here? Well, if you look at the curves, you'll see that there's a lack of observations in a certain belt of time, which actually is the late winter, early spring period, spring, in the spring generally, no observation or very, very few. That is the period of the sun gap. You notice that last year, 2022, the maximum was well observed. These were all by home astronomy observations using bare eye with binocular or telescope. The AAVSO also collects information in other wavelengths, ultraviolet, various bands of infrared also. But for this purpose, I just took the data for the visual, which is the far and away the greatest number of reports turned into AAVSO. Now, at the beginning of the year 2023, in the lower right, the star bottomed out and we got a good view of the minimum. And now we're coming to a rise early this year, and it's still on the rise now, but we have entered another sun gap. So that's why the last observation was in March, and that probably for some observer where they could catch Cetus in evening twilight, and now the sun is passing around in front of the star, the same longitude of the star, and you're probably going to get no observations until late May coming into June. I give you this chart now because, like I say, I have readers in the northern and southern hemisphere and in all different parts of their time zones, so some of you will probably get a hold of that star. Okay, question. How the hell do you measure the brightness of the star? The time is trivial. You look in the lower corner of your computer screen or upper corner on your mobile, you have the date and hour. The magnitude assessment you make, how do we do that? AAVSO and other large variable star orgs elsewhere in the world issue charts for the field of view around the variable, not just mirror, but for thousands of others also. And in this picture here, it's about 10 degree field of view, so you can actually see a couple of the other Greek letter designations, and the caput seti covers the upper left corner, and the little crosshair or index crosshair in the middle is the location of the star. You will notice that many of the stars have two or three numbers next to them, and they are the magnitude ratings of stars by which you will compare mirror against. In the ideal case, you would pick a star a little bit brighter and a little bit dimmer, and using the magnitude ratings for those two stars, you guesstimate the rating for mirror. Now, no star is 87th magnitude, forget it. What happens is, if we were to put the decimal point in there, it would look like a star, and you may be looking for that star in the sky, you can't find it. So by convention, the magnitudes are always given to the tenth. So the last digit is always the tenth of a magnitude, and any digits in front of that, the first or the first two, is the actual magnitude. So the star, which may be labeled 87, is really 8.7 magnitude. Another thing is that nowadays you can get these charts from the AVSO website. You key in the name of the star, maybe the field of view, and whether you want it direct view like this or mirrored, because some telescopes do invert and flip the image, and then you get a presentation on screen, and you can print it, and it normally will be black stars on a white background. Okay, a little bit of history. When AVSO was young in the 1910s and even up to the 1970s, there was no easy way to make duplicates of a master chart. The charts were drawn, they got one of their members who was good at penmanship and drafting, mechanical drawing, to draw the lines and letter all the stuff on it, and he would draw it on a sheet of paper using black ink on a white translucent sheet. Then AVSO would take that sheet, go up the road a bit to a construction company which had the machine that makes blueprints. They probably paid him a fee for that. And the blueprint machine would print charts which were on blue background with white dots, just like a regular blueprint. And this was fabulous because, apart from getting copies to send to members, it was also a lot easier on the eye, especially at night with a dim light, to see white lettering on a dark background than if you used a red lamp for night vision protection. Red does not reflect off a blue background, and the chart looks as if it's made on black background. So for this slide here, I took the black on white field image from AVSO and did a negative on it in an image proc and presented here, and it does resemble, except for the actual color, black rather than blue, the traditional AVSO charts. So that is what you are doing. This 10 degree field is for when the star is bright within binocular range. When it gets really bright, third magnitude to second magnitude, you have to go farther afield and pick stars in Aries or in Taurus of comparable brightness, and for that you may pick the magnitudes from a competent planetarium program, one that uses, say, the Tycho catalog embedded in it. And 29 shows a narrow field, 1 degree, for use when the star is dim. And for whatever reason, the large white disk with the 4 spikes is the location of the star. I'm not sure why they did it that way. In any case, again, the same rule. You look at the stars around it, find which one is close in as far as brightness, and you kind of box in the star between a slightly brighter and a slightly dimmer. Now, that's, of course, an ideal situation, but that's the goal anyway. So a 1 degree field is suitable for a low power telescope eyepiece. I do remind that in this and the previous picture, north is up. When you look in the sky, say with binoculars, north almost for certain will not be vertically up toward the zenith. And in a telescope, depending on which way the rotation of the field puts north, it will not be at the top of your field of view. You must rotate the picture so that the star field on it matches in orientation the stars you see in the sky. If you don't do that, or you get it wrong, you will be lost. So just remember that. When you have a star field, unless it includes the horizon or explicitly tells you this is a bare eye view, like the previous slide or two when I showed the looking east, you saw the skyline underneath it, and you knew that the zenith was upwards, north was to the left, and south was to the right. In general, though, you may have to double check your map before you stand it upright and then go outside and try to use it. Last slide, 30, is a list of other stars besides Mira that are bright, long-period, variable stars. I just stopped the list pretty much at the naked eye limit, so that in the ideal situation, good eyesight, clear dark sky, you will see all of these stars, given your latitude, when it is near maximum. Of course, Mira is the one on top, Omicron Ceti, and then we have other stars under it, stepping down the next in brightness and so on, the brightness of the maximum. They're in order of the maximum brightness. The last column is a little interesting. I was going to just give the distance and snip off the error or tolerance, especially because these were from the Gaia astrometry, which is still ongoing. It came from the Database 2 edition. But then I said, hey, you know, it's a good illustration of how astronomy functions. Very few facts in astronomy are absolutely known. And even with the Gaia mission, which is by far the best astrometry satellite that we have, there is an error or tolerance, plus or minus, for the distances to these stars. The distances are in parsec, and you may see that the variation, plus or minus, can be pretty severe. The star near the bottom is like 900 something parsecs away. It's the farthest star in this particular list, but the error is a couple hundred parsecs. So you may want to, for the hell of it, do a plus or minus percent versus the actual distance and graph that up and see if the tolerance is uniform for this distance range, or does it worsen the farther out you are. Might be an interesting exercise. But that is not your quiz. Your quiz is, if you look at the names of the stars, there's a heavy predominance of stars named R, like in Romeo. There are a couple of S for Sierra, and I think T maybe. Well, because RR, double R, which used to be the 4th Annual Local Train in New York City, that is your quiz. Why do these stars have R or some other alphabetic letter? And the answer is looking up and studying how do we designate variable stars. Now, I'll give you a hint. It was developed in the early 1800s when we got to realize variable stars probably are very important, and we better find a means of designating them other than proper name or using the Greek letters. So your quiz is, how are variable star designations assigned? So until next time, pray for clear skies.